Hi, I'm Jonathan Ziering, the Associate Editor of Kolmogorov for the Wolf Campus, and we'd like to welcome you to our fourth Kolmogorov lecture, the first one of the second semester. Tonight our topic is brain death, halacha, and ethics, and we're pleased to introduce Rabbi Aryeh Klapper. Aryeh Klapper is the Dean of the Center for Modern Torah Leadership and the Rosh Beit Midrash of the Center of Beit Midrash, which is a program under the Center for Modern Torah Leadership. I studied there for 2 years, and I'm privileged to get a chance to introduce Rabbi Klapper. It's also, I think, a first for Kolmogorov that we get to introduce a former editor of our predecessor, Hamavasser, which I think is that our first doing that. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce Rabbi Klapper. Rabbi Klapper is known as being a very creative and insightful speaker, and I'm sure his lecture will live up to those expectations.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Wow.
I was told I would have more authority if I talk without a tie. I apologize to those of you who are expecting. Otherwise, and apparently in this audience, it's better to look like an academic. All right. But nonetheless, I shall begin with a classic rabbinic beginning, which was Poskin B'chvod Achsania. As Jonathan mentioned, I was editor of Hamavasser for a year and a half during my undergraduate days. I think it's probably both the most fun and most influential thing I did in my life was to be editor of Hamavasser. I think, you know, all of you probably know, if you have your own history, you know, that among the roster of editors of Hamavasser back in my day include Yossi Prager, who's the head of the Avichai Foundation, Reuven Ziegler, who's the director of the VBM, and the executive editor when I was editor-in-chief the first year is Rabbi Ries, who's the Menahel of Ries right now. So it's pretty great. It's a pretty wild roster that Hamavasser produced. I think it's not unfair to say that the Hamavasser of old is a primary source of modern orthodoxy as we know it today. And then I need to say that Kol Hamavasser now seems to me in every way superior to the journal I edited. And that gives me tremendous hope for the future, that its quality, quantity, every which way is better now than when I edited it. And it's very hard for me to say because there are very few things I was more proud of than the journal edited. So, yashakoch echad to them. I do hope that some or many of you will spend time learning with me so that I can be part of that bright future as well. Now, I've spent more than a month, actually, preparing for this lecture, trying to figure out two things. One is what my position is on the issues associated with brain death. And two, what I can usefully say to you about those issues. And as you'll see in the context of the shiur, I'm not sure I've solved the first question. I don't know what my issues are. And we'll try and figure out whether I've solved the second or whether I can say anything useful. Now, the barriers to my saying something useful, obviously, are one is that I have no formal medical, biological, or other scientific expertise. And two, that many Talmidei Chachamim and Poskim are greater than I have already written treatments, sometimes comprehensive, of this issue. I'm aware there are people in the audience who know both more about the Torah and more about the science of this issue than I do. Furthermore, I consider myself a Talmid of at least two of the greater Talmidei Chachamim and Poskim, Rabbi J. David Bleich and Rabbi Mordechai Willig. And as my wife Deborah made the point rather strongly when I first accepted the topic for this lecture, there are also issues of being Mor Halecha Bifnei Rabbo in my coming to YU and talking about a topic that my Rebbeim have treated so extensively. And I'm not going to make the claim that it's Makam Chil Hashem and Chulkin Kavod L'Rav, although I know that others may have. Okay, so as a result of that, what I want, can you move up so I don't have to shout? Can you move up so I don't have to shout? I mean, okay, encourage everyone to move. There's a whole front row. So I will not. What I'm not going to do is make an extensive attempt to convince you that a particular reading of either the Mitzvot, either the reality, or the sources is correct. Although, afterwards, I'm happy to answer questions about how I read particular sources, assuming I'm aware of them, and how I understand particular facts. What I rather presume is that each side of the controversy as it's currently presented has advantages and disadvantages, both in terms of understanding the reality and in terms of understanding the Makorot. What I'll do is put out my own assumptions about these and some other issues without seeking to convince you of their truth. And that my primary goal is to relate the halachic debate to other elements of the conversation, discuss the practical outcomes of unresolved halachic debates, and to try to clarify the stakes of the conversation. Right? In light of those ideas, in light of trying to put the halachic debate in context, trying to talk about what happens after you finish the halachic conversation, and trying to talk about what the stakes are on each side, then at the end I will make a very tentative suggestion as to how we might proceed with integrity in light of everyone else's position. So I want to begin by presenting the discussion, what we'll call the pro and anti-brain death positions, as they are often framed to some degree by, as each side to some degree often presents itself, but more the way each side is presented by the other. Okay, so here's one way of presenting the conversation. On one side, we'll call this the anti-brain death side, you have what Benjamin Friedman, the author of a wonderful book called Duty and Healing, called the physicalist perspective. The physicalist perspective is the notion that halakha has to stay exactly the same as it used to be on the facts. And his mashal of that is Rav Moshe Feinstein in one place suggesting that the reason it's mutter to give, the reason it's permitted to donate blood is because Chazal say that having bloodletting is healthy. So obviously there's no problem of chavala if you donate blood because after all it's healthy for you. Right? Now it happens to be true that Chazal said that having blood taken from you is permitted, but we no longer accept the notion that bloodletting is healthy. And so to justify the current halacha on that basis requires what we call a pure physicalist perspective. So the claim is that the anti-brain death side is standing on that perspective, which is to say it claims that brain death fails halachically because it is not an exact continuation of the way in which death was determined by Jews throughout halachic history. Now the problem with that, of course, is that both our knowledge and our technology have changed, so that the meaning of the relevant physical criteria have changed in the world outside halacha. So for example, we understand the role of the heart, the lungs, and the brain differently than they were understood by Rashi or the Chacham Tzvi. And furthermore, it's possible to replace the functions of the lungs and the heart in a way that wasn't possible 100 years ago. So the pro-brain death position likes to present the anti-brain death position as being based on this pure physicalism, in which we say, but you know what, that's not a sensible way to frame it, because reality has shifted dramatically and it doesn't make sense to frame halakha. On the other hand, the anti-brain death people sometimes like that posture because it puts them in a pure traditionalist perspective. Right? We are doing halakha exactly the way the Chacham Tzvi did it, exactly the way Rashi did it. Now, the other side, right, when the anti-brain death side presents the pro-brain death side, they tend to say as follows. The pro-brain death people are being influenced by outside ethical principles. Right? They're giving in to the scientific model. The moral consensus of secular scientists, the transplant lobby, and they're choosing ethics over the autonomous process of halakha. They say that the pro-brain death side is fully aware that accepting the brain death criteria would save the lives of many ill people, but as the anti-brain death people say, look, we can't care about whether we're saving lives of people or not. We have to read the tradition. Okay, so one way of presenting the debate is you have the pure traditionalists on one side who just want to do halakha the way it used to be, and on the other side you have the people who are taking into account ethics, and the question is, where do those ethics come from? Okay. I want to suggest that both of these are incorrect. That the anti-brain death position is not in any way a traditionalist position, and that ethics are not by any means on the side of the pro-brain death position. And that I want to object as strenuously as I can to the overall picture presented that way. I don't want to understand the brain death controversy as a contest between halachic formalism and ethics. Okay, and here's why. Any discussion of the relationship between halakha and ethics should begin with a line that's found in various Masechtot, which says, depending on which version you have, either "Mai chazit d'damadidach sumak tvei" or "Mi yemar d'damadidach sumak tvei." As some of you know, it's probably, I think, one of my favorite, maybe the most important line in the Talmud. The Talmud wants to know, what sorts of things do you have to die before doing religiously? And it answers that for Avodah Zarah, that you can't commit whatever Avodah Zarah is translated as, not idolatry, it's alien worship, whatever, you have to die before committing that we can derive from the Torah. That you have to die before committing adultery and various other sexual crimes, well, that we derive by analogy. There's a biblical verse that draws an analogy between arayot and bloodshedding. But how do I know that I can't kill somebody else to save my life? So that, the Gemara says, that's a svara. What kind of svara is it? A moral svara. A moral svara, who says that my blood is redder than yours? Now, Rav Chaim Brisker, in his commentaries on Hilchot Yesodei HaTorah, reads the Rambam as reading this phrase, not as you might think, as a license to say, well, and whenever I have a reason to think my blood is redder, I can in fact kill you to save my life. But rather, he reads it, and we'll do it without the lumdus, he reads it as saying that you're never allowed to ask that question. You have to work on, right, you have to delegitimate the claim, the question, what have you seen for saying your blood is redder? Rather, anytime halakha views the other as alive, you have to, such that killing them is defined halachically as a violation of shfichut damim, then even if their blood is not objectively as red as yours, for example, if they are a fetus, or if they are a trefa, or if you happen to have particularly invidious perspectives, if you're Jewish and they're not, or if you're male and they're female, or if you're a Kohen and they're Yisrael, right, whatever you may think makes, right, whatever you might be tempted to believe makes your blood redder than theirs. Right, Reb Chaim Brisker says, and reads the Rambam as saying, and I find this perspective compelling, that you're not allowed to let that question affect your behavior. Practically, you're never allowed to think that your blood is redder than somebody's else. You have to, right, even if they are a fetus or a trefa, you have to treat them as if they were equal. It seems reasonable to suggest that in this understanding, the Talmud contends that the core of Jewish ethics, the essential moral svara, is that we do not evaluate the relative worth of lives. In that perspective, it is the anti-brain death position that is based on ethics. And the burden of ethical proof is shifted. Right? Because if the core of the Jewish moral svara is that you're not allowed to decide which life is more valuable, so then the argument that you can save lives by doing this, which really is an argument that the lives you are saving is more valuable than the risk to, the donor, right? The donor might be alive. That is antithetical to Jewish ethics, right? I suggest that the perspective I prefer is that the pro-brain death argument is based explicitly or implicitly on the claim that the lives of the donors are worth less than those of the patients. And this should be deeply troubling from a Jewish ethical perspective, not from a pure halachic formalist perspective. Hold on, take questions at the end. Okay, there is a, save him up. All right, there is a there's another ethical difficulty with the pro-brain death perspective, which, to give it a Jewish name, we'll call the ir miklat problem. By which I mean to say that the adoption of the brain death criterion means that there is at all times a large human population whose survival depends on the deaths of other human beings, in particular on the deaths of young and healthy other people by gunshot wound or auto accident. There will never be enough donors to satisfy the demand, and the situation grows worse as violent crime decreases and auto safety improves. Patients are told, right, if you need a transplant, patients are told never to travel on holiday weekends, because that's when most of the car crashes occur. All right, so if you need a transplant, make sure you stay home, because that's when you're most likely to get one. It seems to me that both the institutionalization of this kind of lottery, imagine if some drug were in some magical way, you had a drug that could only be limited for half the number of patients, whatever the number of patients is in the world. So that we have a permanent situation in which everyone who has this particular illness has a 50% chance of survival and has to flip a coin with one other person to survive. Right? That's a deeply troubling moral universe in which you permanently set up an environment in which only some people can survive, and the choice among them has to be based either randomly or on some kind, right, or on some kind of calculus as to whose life is worth more than somebody else's. Right, the perverse incentive of creating an environment in which some people pray for others' deaths, right, and that's why I call it the ir miklat problem, because that's what the situation of the Kohen Gadol and all those who committed accidental homicide, they'd be praying for the Kohen Gadol to die so that they would go free. This, I think, is deeply troubling. So for these reasons, I think it would, from a textual Jewish ethical perspective, right, meaning I'm not coming from ethics anywhere outside the Jewish tradition, but from ethics internal to the Jewish tradition, but I think which also have a great deal of objective rational validity, it would be better to avoid adopting the brain death criterion. And if you were to tell me that the objection to this is pikuach nefesh, I would tell you, you are exactly the person for whom the Gemara wrote who says your blood is redder than his. It's exactly that argument, the argument that the argument that one has to choose one life or another because one life is more valuable, that the Gemara is opposed to. Okay, that is from the perspective of ethics. Now, what about the perspective of which way is really the traditional physicalist perspective? So I want to suggest that actually there is no traditionalist perspective on the issue, which is to say that nobody thinks that we determine death the way people did 300 years ago, because almost everybody has in their criterion of death some kind of notion of irreversibility. And what kind of things are reversible has changed. So things that were death 300 years ago, once you put that in, are not death anymore. There's no way to avoid that. The whole concept of autonomous versus non-autonomous modes of respiration is an entirely new phenomenon. Nobody could put in autonomous respiration as a criterion 200 years ago because there was no non-autonomous respiration. What would that mean? So I'll come back to that in more detail in a minute, but I want to set up, at least initially, I want to suggest that the debate is inaccurately framed as a claim on the one hand that there are some people who are thinking ethically and other people who are thinking in terms of formal halakha, and we have to choose as to whether to allow ethics to influence formal halakha. Actually, there is no formal halakhic position either way, and the ethical argument is at least equally strong in both directions. Okay. So I have suggested that my own perspective, based entirely on reading ethical texts of the tradition, is that it would be better if we were not to adopt the brain death criterion. But just as halakha generally is and ought not be decided purely by reading texts, so too ethics. So I have two problems with concluding the shir at that point, of saying that I think that ethics tend to indicate that one should not adopt the brain death criterion. The first point, and I'm going to use here a term that is drawn from other disciplines, but it's really interesting to think about how it should affect internal Orthodox conversation. The term is lived experience. Right? If we wanted to put it in halachic terms, we would say puk chazi mayam adavar. Right? What is the popular practice? What is the religious intuition of the observant community? Right? What happens if you say Hanach Lehem Yisrael and Lav Neviim Heim B'nei Neviim Heim? I should say that I'm not a Johnny come lately to this position. When the RCA, when I first heard that the RCA Vad Halacha was considering rewriting its position on brain death, so I actually sent a letter in which I said, you know, maybe the proper answer here is just to leave it alone. But we'll talk about whether that works or not. So I think that it is clear as of now that the default position in the Orthodox community has been not to sign donor cards, but to receive organs when necessary. Now, I don't want to discuss here, although I have discussed in different contexts, whether this is an obvious natural consequence of how one handles sfeikot arising out of giant machlokot between rabbanim, or whether, conversely, this is an obvious obligation of either shvichut damim or bizrayu deritzicha. Right, both of these, I think, are plausible formal halachic positions, either that we just regard this, it's a safek deraisa, right, and we treat it that way, or that it's obviously by accepting organs you're being complicit in a halachically meaningful way in murder. But what this says to me, if I try to function as a pasik, is that if I issue a ruling against brain death, all that will happen is that the status quo will continue. Right? Nobody will stop receiving organs because I said that. A few people might not donate, maybe, but fundamentally, all one can do by enlisting on one side of the debate or another is to continue the status quo, which is that people do not donate and do receive. And I will go further. I doubt very much whether there is more than a handful or even a handful of cases in which Frum Jews have refused to accept organs that were made available to them or refused to be put on transplant lists. I think there was one cause celeb a year and a half ago of one rabbi in Israel who did not put himself on a transplant list because of a psakigat. But I am unaware of any other cases. So it seems to me that we have a fairly strong intuition in the Jewish community that receiving organs is permitted. And if one believes that that intuition is has to be based on the notion that brain death is death, then we have an issue if we want to pass them the other way.
I'll make the question sharper subjectively. More directly, it's fairly clear to me that if I paskin against accepting brain death, I would, if asked the shaila about whether it's permitted to receive organs, refer to somebody who paskined otherwise. And probably, even if I were asked the chas v'shalom, I were in a position of asking the question to myself, I would probably decide that I was too biased and ask the question to somebody else. And I don't like coming to theoretical halachic positions, let alone on life and death issues, that I wouldn't be able to follow myself. And furthermore, it's not clear that I would feel feel that I had committed a moral error by acting against my own halachic intuition. So it seems to me that my practical instinct and the practical instinct of the Frum community that does not really see refusal of organs as a life option is not based on the lamdish ayla of whether lifnei iver on ritzicha is yehareg vel yavor. Right. You know, that there's this broad halachic consensus that that contributing to somebody else's murder is not yehareg vel yavor and you're allowed to do that. No, I don't think so. Aside from the question of whether that's even a defensible position, given the way in which the transplants are set up right now and the relationship between donors and and recipients, whether it's really just lifnei iver or whether there isn't some kind of stronger category. Rather, it seems to me that the reason that just about all of us would take organs if the situation came up and would tell our relatives to take organs and would not in any way try to dissuade people from joining transplant lists is that in fact we believe that the patient's life is more valuable than the donor's. We think the patient's life is more valuable than the donor's. We're willing to allow the organs to be taken from person X to be given to person Y because we think that the recipient is more valuable than the donor. It may be that the decision not to donate is based on a lack of sense of immediacy, right? That when it comes to donate, we don't realize that we don't have the immediate awareness that a life depends on the decision to donate. It doesn't really depend immediately, it's an abstraction, right? Sometime in the future, if God forbid I die while young and healthy of a gunshot wound or an auto accident, then somebody else's life might depend on that. So we don't recognize the question as immediately. Or it may be that the life one is in contact with always seems more precious than an abstract someone else. And that's an intuition we could put a halachic weight to in the Noda Yehuda's concept of chol lefanenu in terms of autopsies. So the question, right, the question then to me is whether given that on the one hand, on a pure question of what Jewish ethics are based on texts, I would say that I'm deeply troubled by any notion that we should make practical decisions based on the question of one, based on the claim that one life is more valuable than another. And on the other hand, I share what seems to be a nearly universal intuition that this life really is more valuable than that life. All right, so I can just recuse myself and say that this is not a psak I can deal with and leave the field to the situation we have right now, which is not donating but receiving. I do think that's a really problematic position. I would be unhappy if that were the situation that were left. And I could recuse myself, I could say that this popular instinct is against the ethics of Torah and stand by what I think is the ethical position even though I wouldn't be able to follow it myself. Or rather, we can look for a katuv hashlishi amachriya b'nehem. And I'd say that we have a contradiction. On the one hand, I think it is correct that there is a really deep Jewish resistance to making choices among lives based on one being more valuable than the other. On the other hand, there seems to be a really powerful intuition that one life here really is more valuable than the other and that should have consequences. So is there a way between them? Okay, so here we need to note that even in Rav Chaim's understanding, there are exceptions to the rule against Mai Chazit. Most clearly, V'chei Achicha Imach, right, in the famous story of the two men in the desert, teaches us that Chayecha Kodmin, right, two people walking in the desert, you hold a bottle of water, you're allowed to drink the bottle of water. Because your life comes before somebody else's. Now how does that square with a central moral intuition who says your blood is redder than his? Secondly, We have a law called Hilchot Rodef. Right? If somebody comes to kill you, you're not only entitled, but perhaps obligated to kill, right, to kill the person who comes against you. And if there's a third person, right, if A is chasing B, you as C have an unquestioned obligation to kill A to save B. Now how is that if who says one person's blood is redder than another's? So obviously the principle who says your blood is redder than his is not an absolute principle in halakha, which means that there are ethical tensions within the tradition on this issue, just as there are halachic tensions. So what I want to do now is restate the halachic issue as I understand it. Right? So far I've been talking mostly about the ethical issues. Now I want to go back to the halachic issue, state the halachic issue the way I understand it, and then based on that, I want to suggest a few possible ketuv hashlishis. First, laniut dati, it is clear that brain death is not identical with either decapitation or permanent cessation of respiration. That is to say, someone can say that brain death equals decapitation because it cuts the brain off from effective communication with the nervous system, even if some cells survive and the hypothalamus remains in connection with the endocrine system. And one is entitled to say that permanent cessation of autonomous respiration is the same as permanent cessation of respiration. But all things being equal, I would say that decapitation requires the head and the body to be actually separated. At least rov basar in the Talmudic phrase, right? Most of the neck, which I note discuss right. When the Talmud talks about decapitation, it discusses decapitation in the context of other gaping wounds, right? Being chopped. Right? You can be sliced this way. You can be sliced this way. You can be sliced this way, right? But it says nothing particular about the brain, right? So all things being equal, I would say that brain death, particularly brain stem death, the way we use it now, is not identical with decapitation. Furthermore, I would say that rather than saying that what we require is permanent cessation of autonomous respiration, it makes more sense to me that we should require permanent cessation of effective respiration, i.e. respiration that oxygenates the blood. Right? Why do we care whether the body is maintained alive by itself, or whether it's maintained alive by something else? The question is the body alive or not? So I think that if I were coming purely from the text, I would have said effective respiration rather than autonomous respiration is key, and that integrates both the heart and the lungs, which I think solves the whole challenge of whether we care more about respiration or about cardiac things, and how that deals with pre-modern things. It's one category, which is effective respiration. On the other hand, it's also clear to me that no pre-modern definition of death could have adequately accounted for the phenomenon of iron lungs. Right? Our people with iron lungs are dead by pre-modern criteria, unless you redefine the criteria to mean something else, or artificial hearts. So the real halachic question, it seems to me, is not whether to adopt a new halachic standard of death, but rather which new standard of halachic death to adopt. Right, because either way, right, whether one adopts brain death, right, or whether one adopts a notion that doesn't focus on the brain but talks about the heartbeat, and the heartbeat has autonomy, all those definitions, right, they all have to, right, they're all new standards in light of new technology, new science, new realities. Now here it seems to me clear that the only motive, right, once we acknowledge that we're adopting a new standard, the only motive for adopting the brain death standard, or at least the primary motive, is the desire for organ transplantation. And that not calling brain death death, sorry, that calling brain death death is a way of formally avoiding the Maichazit issue. Right, that's why we want to call them dead, because if they weren't dead, then we would be explicitly saying some lives are more valuable than others, and we all know that halakhically you can't say some lives are more valuable than others. So we call them dead. Now, I want to be clear. I don't think this is dishonest. Because I think, and this is a much larger issue, that death is a social, cultural, and legal construct, not an objective phenomenon, and I'll note that more forcefully below. But we should, at least at this stage, acknowledge the choice that we are making. Right? We're making the decision to call this death because it enables organ transplantation. And the question we have to ask is whether this is wise or necessary. So here I need to note that I am influenced, and I thank my friend, Rabbi Dr. Don Seaman, who also is a professor in anthropology, for making me aware of a book called Twice Dead, by the anthropologist Margaret Locke, which is a study, among other things, of the cultural meaning and conversation about brain death in the United States and Japan. And the fun of it is that you have two cultures with roughly similar technologies, but very, very different conversations on the subject. And one of the points that was made in that book, which has the most impact on me, is that Locke makes clear that intensive care unit nurses often or generally refer to brain dead patients as alive. And it's removing them from ventilators as ending their lives, sometimes ending their lives for the second time, which is why her book is called Twice Dead. It seems to me, therefore, that categorizing this as death runs real risk of making us what we call a felt lack of integrity. We call it death, but we know that the reason we're calling it dead is to enable organ transplantation, and that if it weren't for the pressure of wishing to allow transplants, we would halachically wait for this what I would call the cessation of effective respiration, which is roughly coterminous with the cessation of heartbeat. Okay. Furthermore, right, if we claim that we're doing it because we're calling it death, my suspicion is that the practical outcome in the Frum community is that people will still not donate because they only believe it enough to receive. But they're not really convinced it's death, and there I think it's very important to be careful not to use definitions of death that are really in conflict with the culture. Right, and if you're dealing with the nurses who deal with this every day are still relating to the patients as alive, it's very hard for people to really think of it as death. So I think that what I call the intuitive dissonance is problematic for us religiously, and the cognitive dissonance is problematic practically because people will in fact end up not donating. So one ketuvah shlishi was proposed by Rabbi Michael Broyd on the Hirhurim blog recently. Rabbi Broyd argues, and here I want to be clear that I'm using a formulation that I've checked with him, and I'm quoting word for word because I wanted to make sure that I was not in any way misrepresenting him. And we agreed to disagree about whether most readers of the Hirhurim blog would have correctly understood him. So this is an authorized formulation. Rabbi Broyd argues as follows: Rabbi Shlomo Zalman Auerbach takes the position that a patient diagnosed as brain dead is sufficiently dead, or sufficiently likely dead, or sufficiently unlikely to recover, that one may do anything to end their lives, short of violating lo tirtzach, including actions that would otherwise be considered shfichut damim, as the Rambam uses the term Hilchot Ritzeach Perek Bet Halacha Bet. Accordingly, one may remove such patients from a respirator, even if one does not consider such removal to be mere hasarat monea, removal of prevention, but rather, even if one considers removing the patient from the respirator to be shfichut damim b'shev ve'al taseh, bloodshedding passively. Having done so, and having removed the patient from the ventilator, which again we're not calling hasarat monea, which we're now calling shfichut damim b'shev ve'al taseh, one may wait until the spontaneous heartbeat has permanently ceased, declare the patient dead by cardiac criteria, now that they have a permanent lack of spontaneous heartbeat, then restart the heart artificially and remove whatever organs are useful. All right, so Rabbi Broyd is arguing again, I'm quoting because I wasn't sure anyone understood that on Hirhurim. Right, and this is following a famous, infamous, notorious experiment reported by Dr. Robert Truog, that what one should do is find a circumstance in which one can declare the patient legally dead by all criteria, although in fact practically the patient will end up being in a condition which is physically indistinguishable from a condition that we otherwise call legally life. All right, so what we do is, right, so following Rosh Shlomo Zalman, and I'm not going to discuss at all what Rosh Shlomo Zalman really held, which is beyond my scope, and I haven't read all the articles and all the counterclaims and things like that. So for now I will work on the presumption that Rabbi Broyd is accurately reporting Rosh Shlomo Zalman's position, and he's built basically on Rabbi Dr. Breidowitz's article years ago. That suggestion is remove the respirator because you are allowed to kill certain kinds of patients passively. Wait till they're dead, which is fine because you did it the wrong way, they're dead by all criteria, and then you restart the heart. Now, this to me, I have to say, is a quite startling contention. It does have the advantage of making the patient actually dead before the harvesting begins, at least legally. But the notion that one can commit passive as opposed to active shvichut damim seems to me deeply, deeply troubling. And I prefer, you know, my tendency, I think, that's pshat and Rav Chaim, is that this is against the Gemara, which says that the Gemara says my chazit adam adiach sumak tvei applies to shvichut damim, not to ritzicha. Right, so I find this a very, very difficult read. Furthermore, why is the patient not deemed resurrected when the heart begins beating again? Right, so they were dead because they had a permanent cessation of spontaneous heartbeat. Now they have a spontaneous heartbeat again, so they're alive again. Right, you can work out all the issues in terms of Yibum, all of which came up in terms of heart transplants originally, and Yerusha, and all sorts of fun issues. So I want to propose an alternate Ketuv HaShlishi, albeit one that I'm sure you'll all notice immediately, also has its own of its own troubling aspects. The Psak in Shulchan Aruch, coming from the Saint Gabar at Chulin as the Psak about decapitation, is, quote, Mi shenishbera mafrekto verov basarima, somebody whose neck has broken, right, together with most of the flesh of, I think I'm translating that correctly, right, together spinal column, mafrekto, fair, spinal column? Now what do you think? Okay, right. Along with most of the flesh, v'chein mi shenikra migabo kedag, and also somebody who has been torn from his back like a fish. I'm not an expert at gutting fish, so I would not wish to tell you how this happens. But then Shulchan has a fascinating line. Afilu adayin hu chai, even if he is still alive, chashiv kemet, he's considered dead. U'metame. Right, and a kohen violates the prohibition of becoming tame by touching this person who is still alive. Now that's a fascinating claim. It's important on its own, right, because it tells us that legal death is not identical with biological death. This patient is still alive, but they're legally dead. And the Shulchan Aruch goes on and says, "Aval goses umi shenishchatu bo bet simanim al patsua p'tzaim harbe." However, a goses, which I will leave undefined for now, or somebody who has both the windpipe and both the trachea and the esophagus cut, or who is wounded in many, many places, they do not make you tame. So even though they are inevitably going to die, they are not yet dead, unlike the first category. Ad shetetzei nafsham, until their nefesh leaves, meaning that the first category, the person who is nishpara mafrakto verov basar ima, is dead, not only even though they're alive, but even though they still have a nefesh. Which means that the Shulchan Aruch is willing to define legal death as distinct from what I would call both biological death and metaphysical death. You can be legally dead while you are, right, still alive and you still have a nefesh. Now, it is possible to argue that the Shulchan Aruch means that you're dead for the purpose of tum'ah, but not for any other purposes, meaning you could not remove organs from such a person, even though a kohen could not touch them. But I would say the burden of proof is on that argument. I assume that when he says chashiv kemet, it means that they are dead completely. Okay. Now, the problem is, why should this be so? Why should we declare legal death here prior to biological death and prior to metaphysical death? So one answer to this, I believe, is given by the Shi'iltot de Rav Achai in Parshat Emor Shi'iltot Kuf Gimel, where he says the following. Where a person fell and his neck is broken and most of the flesh has been cut along with it, even though his nefesh has not yet departed, metu, this person is dead. And his soul is merely a prisoner in the body. Okay, so here we have a new conception of what the criteria for death are. Right, this person is called dead, not because they are biologically dead, and not because their soul has left, but because their soul is not intrinsically, organically in their body. Their soul is a prisoner in their body, and they really should be dead. Now that's a shiltot. You know, it doesn't seem to have had any impact later in halachic discourse. But there are two tshuvot which say things that are strikingly parallel to that shilta. Letzitz Eliezer has asked the question about removal of emergency room accident victims who have been taken to the emergency room from ventilators. So he begins with a tremendous rhetoric, which is all powerful to read, even though I have to say I disagree with it very strongly, but it's very powerful to read, in which he says that keeping patients alive in certain conditions is bad. Right? Patients deserve what he calls a mitat yafed, a mitat kavod, an honor, a good and dignified death. They should not be transformed in lelot toelet without purpose. Liyitzur to a creation. Im tzinorot rabim with many, many tubes. Hamei abeda tzelem elokim shebo. That destroys the tzelem elokim in them. Now, I am not fond of describing the body as the tzelem elokim to such an extent that having lots of tubes coming out of you destroys the tzelem elokim, which I prefer to identify with the mind or the soul. But you should understand that Tzitz Eliezer takes this rhetoric very seriously. His response in the end is that what emerges according to the following is that even according to the Rama, who says that for a gosei zman aruch, you can remove a moneah, but you cannot hasten their death, it is permissible, it's permissible even actively to remove the ventilator. Because by doing so, biyoch al yedei kein, mafsikim rak tnuat hachiyut haba'a lo min hachutz. All you are doing is removing the life that is being provided to this person externally. In other words, for the Tzitz Eliezer, the hasarat monea, the removal of an obstruction, is not a physical judgment as to what is internal to the body and external body, and external to the body. It's a metaphysical judgment as to whether the life in this body is really external to the body, really internal to the body. And he suggests that removing the ventilator from such patients is always called hasarat monea. And I suggest, right now I have to say no one else has agreed with me about this, but it seems to me clear that for the Tzitz Eliezer, it doesn't matter how you kill the patient. Because if the reason that it's hasarat moneah to remove the ventilator is that the life is being provided externally, you should be able to shoot them too. Because you're still just removing an external life. Now there are ancillary reasons that you should not be able to shoot them, like nivul hamet, right, things like that, but fundamentally, the Tzitz Eliezer, like the She'iltot, takes the position that there are patients in certain conditions where the entire halachic framework of relationship changes because they're not supposed to be alive and they're not really alive. They're only biologically alive. Okay, a similar notion, much made even more strongly, is provided by Rabbi Chaim David Halevi, an article in Tchumen Bet, which I'm only going to offer you in translation. It seems to my impoverished intellect that even if the doctors wish to continue and keep them alive via the respirator, they are not permitted to do so, as it has already been explained that it is forbidden to extend the life of the goses, etc. Here we go, right? For indeed the nefesh of human being, which is the property of the Holy One who is blessed, has already been taken by the Holy One who is blessed from this human being. Right? As he will die immediately once the machine has been removed, quite the reverse. Via this artificial respiration, we are leaving the nefesh within him and causing the nefesh suffering, for it is not able to return and separate and return to its place of rest. Therefore, it seems to my impoverished intellect that it is permitted to you, when you have reached a clear conviction with no room or doubt for challenge, that there is no longer hope for this human being to be healed, to detach him from the respirator, and you can do this, and he's very clear, you can do this without any pangs of conscience. So I want to suggest as follows. Brain death is not death, or at least possibly not death, likely should not be death, or is not yet death. Right, because the poskim simply haven't, right, if all the poskim decide it's death, then it's death halachically. But we still have a machloket, at least. It might be preferable to follow this position consistently and advocate the banning of both the donation and receipt of organs. And we should certainly encourage the development of alternate technologies for transplantation, as we did with regard to the destruction of embryos for stem cell research, where when we banned it, it turned out that there were ways of solving it, of accomplishing at least some of the things that way. We should look for that, for all the ethical reasons I set forth. However, but if one knows that one will receive organs and advise the receiving of organs and not feel that by doing so one is violating a Yehereg Vel Ya'avor, one should adopt the position that one is permitted to end the lives of brain-dead patients actively. If one adopts this position, which I am suggesting is the position that follows from the Tzitz Eliezer and Rav Chaim David Halevi, although I have to note that the Tzitz Eliezer requires the cessation of a cessation of heartbeat as well. I don't know what reality he's talking about, in which you're providing both, right, in which both the respiration and the heartbeat is being provided artificially. So I don't want to claim the Tzitz Eliezer as authority, What I want to claim is that the Shilta, the Tzitz Eliezer, and the Aseh L'Charab all work along the same axis, that there is a category of patient who is considered to be artificially alive for whom there is no prohibition to kill. In that context, right? In that context, one can say that the question of transplantation becomes a variant of the autopsy question. Right? It's not about killing, because there's no issue of killing anymore. It's about whether you can mar the body. And whatever standard one take, everyone agrees that you can do an autopsy if you have a cholel lefaneinu, if you have an alternative sick person next to you. And transplants right now, there's always another sick person who's immediately available. Right, so therefore, it seems to me that if one is not going to be consistent in denying brain death as death, that you can use this rationale to permit both donation and receipt without without conflicting with that position that brain death is not death, and that's the position one ought to take if you know that you're going to receive organs and advocate the receipt of organs. I should note that there is one other mode of approach, which is to suggest that it is permitted for one person to sacrifice their life for somebody else or multiple others. And that it's permitted to accept such a sacrifice from somebody else, in which case consent would be sufficient regardless of the issue. I understand that a book is coming out or has come out in Israel addressing this issue in the context of the military, in the context of a soldier who threw himself on a grenade to save his men. So I look forward to reading that book. Right now I don't understand the issue well enough to say that I'm comfortable using it as more than a supplementary approach. Finally, is it possible, and it seems to me in the long run advisable, to try to combine the two approaches so that informed consent to donation becomes a halachic as well as a secular legal requirement, well, the technical means by which that should be accomplished seems to me secondary tonight. So bottom line, what I want to suggest is that there's a really good argument to say that brain death is not death. I prefer taking that argument. There isn't a really good argument for saying that brain death is not death and then taking organs anyway, leaving aside the moral question of whether you reach that conclusion based on distinctions among Jews and non-Jews, which again, to me, that's exactly what my chazit is intended to prevent. Given that the reality of our community is that people accept organs, it seems to me that the best halachic outcome is to say that we should permit donations as well, not by saying that brain death is death, but by saying that there's a category of patients whom one is permitted to kill just for their own good, kal v'chomer, one can do it for the bikoach nefesh of others.
My name is Serpent David. I am one of the editors of Kol Mevaser. We have 2 minutes for questions.
Only one question?
Sure, ask.
Yes. I think you're going into all kinds of unnecessary kinds of arguments if one is willing to look at the straightforward issues of is brain death from a scientific point of view, or is heart death, or whatever. And then you go to the consequences of that. One does not have to make these somersaults in terms of arguments of the ethical issues if you already say that brain death is only argued by people who want to give donations. I am sure there must be some scientists out there who consider brain death just for the issues at hand.
I'll answer the question very straightforwardly. Death is not a scientific concept. There is no conceivable way in which one can reach. If you have a definition of death, which is morally
biological.
No, there isn't, right? But death is a process, right? People in the grave still have live cells, right? We see in the Shulchan Aruch that people who are perfectly biologically alive are nonetheless considered dead. We have other contexts where people are called legally dead and they're biologically alive. For example, people who have been convicted of capital crimes, halachically, are legally dead although they are perfectly biologically alive. So I object very strongly to the notion that there can ever be a scientific definition or a scientific argument for brain death purely. If you already have a legal definition of death, so let's say if I say the legal definition of death is permanent cessation of respiration, then it is possible to take a scientific position as to whether this respiration has ceased permanently. But the definition of death, but whether the definition of death is permanent cessation of respiration, or permanent cessation of autonomous respiration, or permanent cessation of effective respiration, that is not a scientific question at all. And so that, right? And on that issue, I think that the impetus for the contemporary definition of brain death, as I understand it, now I will say I'm less cynical. I used to think that cost was also a factor. The cost of leaving patients, and availability of emergency room equipment and things like that. My current understanding is that that is not as major an issue as I thought, so I'm turning it back to transplant. On there, I'm open, I'm taking sides in a broad debate among medical ethicists. There are those people who make this argument about the Harvard criterion all along, that it was just developed to allow transplants, or even worse, to prevent transplant surgeons from being convicted of murder. That's largely Dr. Locke's position in her book. I don't want to go quite that far. I think it was a moral decision made under the pressure of the feeling that transplants were a good thing. Okay, yes, Shalom.
You made the argument before that since there aren't enough car crash victims to provide
Rahman al-Islam,
that it would therefore be immoral to support that. I just don't understand where that comes from. I mean, if you can only save a few lives, why not?
So, okay, good. So what I want to suggest is, it's not a dispositive argument. It's a discomfort. That to create a situation permanently in which some people have a right live only because others die is not a happy situation. It's not.
You'd rather have everyone die?
So if I were sure, if I were sure that it was, that was the only way to frame it, but medically it doesn't happen that way, where you're creating a situation where you're permanently stuck, that you could never do it that way, and where this is an anomalous situation, and we should be aware that if we had no choice, if those patients were dead and these patients were alive, I had no choice to make, I'd live with the discomfort. But now I'm saying, as you're asking me to make the decision to legally create this situation, it doesn't have to be. And that I'm not, I think I have discomfort about creating a situation where some people pray for the death of others, where, where the families of people with liver disease, have a perverse incentive to root against seatbelt laws. Or to advocate against drunk driving laws and things like that. That seems to be poor public policy. It's not dispositive.
Is the very incentive that they have, or the fact that people actually do it?
I don't know if people actually do it. There's all sorts of literature about what actually happens with families in transplant rooms and whether, it's clear that when you actually do the study, people are watching, and so the criteria get better, whether they get institutionalized or not. I'd rather not make the argument on the pragmatic question of whether people get pushed or not. I'd rather just say the Gemara recognizes that having people pray for the death of the Kohen Gadol is bad. So we should also recognize that. If we have to do it, we have to do it. But we should recognize that it's a cost. It militates against... If I have a choice as to how to paskin it, it influences me one way. All right. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Rabbi Klapper. If you'd like to sign up for his emails, there's a sign-up sheet in the back. On the table. Also, a few things about Kolmavasser. Our upcoming issue is perm issue, so if you'd like to submit, please. You have about a week to do so, any perm door, please send it in. And also, the issue after that will be on Medina Israel, so if you'd like to write, please start work on your articles, contact us. We love for your submissions. And also, there is currently another lecture going on for someone who needs a bone marrow transplant. So we urge you to all stop by at the bar and sale and register for the Gift of Life to get swabbed to see if you're a match. Thank you all for coming.